This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not easy prosecuting terrorism cases. In a drug bust, police can catch the dealers in the act. In terror cases, they can't wait that long. But even given the difficulty, the record of the Bush administration on going after terrorists after 9/11 is a record of remarkable flubs. And last week came the most flamboyant flub yet. Zacharias Moussaoui had made it easy. He pleaded guilty to capital murder as a conspirator in the 9/11 attacks themselves. All that was left was a sentencing trial. And last week it emerged that a government attorney had coached key witnesses. Coaching against a judge's direct order is a crime. Up next on Point, breaking all the rules, legal minds, and 9/11 families on the mess of the Moussaoui trial. Joining me now from Washington for the latest on the Moussaoui trial is Johanna Newman, who's been covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. Johanna, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What's going on in the courtroom this morning?
Well, they're going back into court. The government will try to put on a case. The judge has now said that the government can call aviation experts if they are not the ones briefed up by Carla Martin, the lawyer who apparently messed up this case.
And Johanna, remind us exactly what it emerged last week happened here.
Well, as you pointed out, Tom, this has been a roller coaster case, and I suppose this was the highest or lowest point of the roller coaster. The government itself alleged that one of its own attorneys had crossed the bounds of ethical behavior by coaching government witnesses. This is just a no-no, and any litigator, anybody who knows the court and the legal process knows better than that. Carla Martin was not a litigator. It's an interesting story. She was a flight attendant who decided to go to law school and combine her knowledge of the airline industry with a law degree. She came out of law school and went to work for the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. Mm-hmm. But she never tried cases for them. She was always an advisor to the agency. And when, after 9/11, the government desperately needed attorneys to serve in the new Transportation Security Administration, Carla was one of the FAA lawyers who went over there to advise the new agency. And again, her role has been to sort of an insider's role, to advise an agency, not to litigate in court.
Now, Johanna, Moussaoui has pleaded guilty. He's facing life in prison, I guess, at a minimum. You tell us. So the issue is whether or not the death penalty is on the table here. What does it appear Carla Martin was coaching these FAA witnesses toward?
Well, her view of the case differed from the government prosecution case. It's a very strange thing, Tom, because the government in this penalty phase is arguing that Moussaoui should get the death penalty because if he had spoken up after he was captured, 9/11 might have been prevented. And I personally am very curious to see what the defense will put on to rebut that. Because it seems to me you could also argue that the FBI might have prevented 9/11. After all, the FBI in Minnesota captured this man. They wanted to search his computer, and FBI headquarters in Washington said no.
So the implication here is that if he had come forward once he was arrested and said, here's what's afoot,
right,
that authorities and airlines could have stopped. They could have stopped the 19 hijackers. They could have confiscated their short blades or whatever. They would have interrupted the 9/11
plan. Well, they would have at least been on alert. And then you can go from there and speculating how effective they would have been.
Now, you're saying Carla Martin was prompting them against this interpretation?
Yes. She was basically coaching them to say that you couldn't prevent this, that this is the basic position of airlines in all the cases that she was involved in at the FAA and now at the TSA. The instinct is no matter what you have, some people are going to get through.
So you're saying she was working against the government case that she was supposed to be supporting?
Well, that's our understanding. Now, she has hired a lawyer. She has not had her day in court. And I did talk to her lawyer the other day, and he says, you know, there's another side. Mm-hmm. The publicity and the press on this has been very one-sided. She has a very different story to tell. Hopefully, we will get to hear that story this week.
The defense attorneys, Massawi's attorneys, I guess, here, are saying that Carla Martin was being prompted by the airlines, that she was roundabout trying to protect them from being sued, as 9/11 families, some of them, want to do.
Well, I don't know if she was doing their bidding, but I know that her whole work history is to defend the airlines. That's the inference, that she comes out of a mindset of protecting the federal agency and the airlines they regulate.
So the trial's back on in Alexandria. A lot of 9/11 families have been watching. Is there enough still here in the holster of the prosecution to have a hope of the death penalty?
I think one of the troubling aspects of their case is that Massawi, when he pled guilty, said he didn't do 9/11, that he was guilty. He is an admitted Al-Qaeda terrorist. He is viciously anti-American. And he says that he was involved in another plot to free the blind sheik.
Mm-hmm. From the 1993 Rahman attacks, right?
Yeah, that he wanted to free him from prison and fly him back home to Afghanistan. So it's now Massawi is a little bit of a loose cannon, if you will. I mean, no one knows what to expect from him. He is sometimes called the hapless 20th terrorist in 9/11 because he was so inept at taking his flight training and so forth. But if that's credible, if in fact he was involved in another plot, then it's hard for me to see how the government's going to be able to persuade the court to give him the death penalty for 9/11.
Looks like a lot of loose cannon flying around here. Joanna Newman at the Los Angeles Times, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Joanna Newman, she's been covering the Massawi trial for the LA Times. She spoke with us from Washington. Joining me now from Roslyn Heights, New York, is Sheila Langone. She lost her two sons in the World Trade Center on 9/11. Peter Langone was 41, a New York City police officer. He left behind a wife, Terry, and two daughters, Nikki and Carly. Thomas Langone was 39, a New York City firefighter. He left behind a wife, Joanne, and two children, Caitlin and Brian. Sheila Langone, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. And a small correction.
Yes.
Peter was the fireman, Tommy was the policeman.
Excuse me, I'm very sorry to get those turned around.
That's all right.
Also with us from New York is Maureen Santora. Her son Christopher died on 9/11 at age 23. He was a New York firefighter for Engine 54 in Manhattan. Santora and her husband Alexander, himself a 40-year firefighter, have been closely following the Massawi trial. Maureen Santora, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Let me go to you first, if I may. You saw what happened last week, these witnesses that appeared to be awfully important to the possibility of a death penalty taken off the table because of mishandling by a government attorney. What do you make of this, Maureen Santora?
Well, for me, it's incomprehensible that the prosecutor's entire case is that Massawi lied, and had he not lied, everything would have been pulled together. I have been watching and just amazement that this would be the crux of the prosecutor's comment, and this just seemed to be like another rung in the broken ladder of success, and I just was very upset that our government would not have had a much more solid case.
Ms. Langone, let me turn to you. It's years now since 9/11. In your sense of the government's overall follow-up on the legal side, are you satisfied with it? Do you feel like justice is being done?
I was up until the point, until this business about the coaching the witnesses. I know that they've, very slowly tried to build this case right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And when this happened, it certainly threw a monkey wrench into the whole works. However, now, according to what I read, the death penalty is back on the agenda, but somehow I feel it will not be accomplished.
Maureen Santoro, your confidence at this point, and I guess beyond that, how important is it to you that the death penalty comes out of this case?
Well, from my personal perspective, there's nothing that's going to bring my son back. What I want to see in this trial is truth and justice. And if, you know, Moussaoui believes, as other, you know, Muslims have professed to believe, that 72 virgins will be waiting for him if he gets, you know, if he dies as a martyr, and he will die as a martyr in the Muslim community if he's gotten the death penalty, then maybe it's something that we should rethink. I just want the truth to come out, and I certainly, you know, if we have not done our work in correcting our positions and our communication in government, then that really needs to be addressed, and I hope that that comes out in the trial. It does not appear that too much has happened since September 11th in terms of communicating with government agencies. For me, whether Moussaoui gets the death penalty or he gets life imprisonment, or it's never going to bring my son back, ever.
We're joined right now from Los Angeles by Lori Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School, where she's also director of the Center for Ethical Advocacy, a former federal prosecutor herself. Lori Levinson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Palo Alto, California, by Mariano Florentino Cuellar, a law professor at Stanford University, former board member of the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. Mariano Florentino Cuellar, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Mr. Cuellar, first to you, how do you interpret what's gone wrong in this Moussaoui case?
Well, you know, I have to put it in the context of a larger anti-terrorism prosecution strategy of the government. With respect to the Moussaoui case in particular, I'm among these people who think that this is not some sort of willful misconduct in the broader scheme of things. You know, individuals might have their own ideas. But I think it's an understandable foul-up given the extraordinary pressure that these prosecutors and advisory lawyers are under. I think if you look at the larger context, though, the set of prosecutions that the government's pursued, there is a larger story to be told, which is about the prosecution's response and the administration's response to immense public pressure and to the need to demonstrate to people that they're doing something effective. And I think in the larger scheme, there have been some really unfortunate missteps.
President Bush has said, look, we've put up hundreds of cases and we've had success in a lot of them. So what's the problem?
Well, the Washington Post did an interesting analysis of this in the middle of 2005, and they found that the repeated claims of the administration from both the Attorney General and the White House that they had achieved about 200 terrorism-related convictions was very inaccurate, and in fact, the actual number was something more like 39. And the discrepancy comes from the way the administration classifies anti-terrorism prosecutions, how they sort of inflate the concept to cover instances where very initial investigator attention might reflect some concern or some interest in a suspect as a potential a supporter of a terrorist organization, but then subsequent investigation just simply turns up, for example, an immigration offense.
So blow it up into something bigger than it is. We'll look at that bigger picture. But Lori Levinson, I don't want to look away from this Moussaoui trial too quickly. It's coming back to life today. It seemed it was just about to completely fall apart last week. Judge Brinkham has given it some kind of second chance here, but she's been around a while, and she says, I don't think in the annals of criminal law there has ever been a case with this many significant problems. You know how much government effort and attention has been focused on this, Lori Levinson. Why so many problems?
Well, I think it may be, frankly, a lack of objectivity by the prosecutors in this case. You know, in most criminal cases, prosecutors have great discretion on whether to bring the case, what type of penalty to seek. But given the notoriety of this case and that they started out by calling him the 20th hijacker, and I think that's really in doubt whether he was one of the would-be hijackers at all, you know, that put a lot of pressure on them to go full force on this case. And along the way, they've had many butts with this judge. Earlier, she said that they shouldn't be able to go for the death penalty because they wouldn't let Moussaoui go ahead and try to get his own witnesses from Guantanamo. She was struck down by the Court of Appeal. Mm. Now they pull this type of stunt. She has very little trust in the prosecution because, frankly, they haven't earned that trust.
Talk to us about coaching witnesses. For many people who don't deal with the judicial system often, this is unfamiliar terrain. Take us into what Carla Martin did that was wrong. What do you think she was trying to do by that, and what's the problem with it?
Well, you know, the prosecutor himself, David Novak, said this is indefensible, and in fact it is, because there was a specific order by the judge not to coach the witnesses, not them, let them know what was said in the opening statements, what the other witnesses would say, so that they wouldn't slant their own testimony. And in fact, that should be the rule in many trials, that you don't want the witnesses tailoring their testimony. They just want them to tell the truth. What Martin did was send an email alerting all of the potential TSA witnesses as to what the prosecutor's theory was, what the defense lawyers would likely go after them, and trying, frankly, I think, to cover up for her own agency and saying, look, they're going to come after us, saying that, you know, this is something that was preventable if he had spoken out, and this is going to put on the hot seat what our procedures are. We've got to be ready for it. So it's really pitting the prosecution, who wants to say, you know, if Musawi had spoken up, they could have prevented 9/11, against the defense lawyers who are going to go after TSA and say, you're so incompetent, it wouldn't have prevented 9/11.
So does it look like Carla Martin was attempting to coach these witnesses toward achieving a death penalty outcome here or not?
It's hard to say. I think that her primary focus was in protecting her agency. In her email, she says she's somewhat flabbergasted by what the prosecutor's theory is, but it's too late to change that. So it seems like her main interest, frankly, is to protect her agency and also to let the witnesses know what's likely to happen when they take the witness stand.
And if I could just go ahead,
yes,
and add,
please,
something, I think that's a very compelling account. I think that makes a lot of sense. And what's important for folks to remember is that it doesn't matter what the coaches goal is. What matters is that the judge has made a decision here that there shouldn't be any coaching. So even if Carla Martin here maybe was trying to sensitize the potential witnesses to what she perceived to be problems in the government's theory, the activities she's still engaging in are violating the order that the judge has made, and that's what the problem is.
But it reflects upstream on the prosecution as well, doesn't it? I mean, I see these TSA or FAA officials saying that the prosecution's theory, that they could have forestalled or stopped 9/11 if only he had spoken up. You've got officials inside saying that's not realistic.
I don't think anybody's buying into this theory, and I think that's really the story here with Martin. I also don't know how much she was told about this court order and how much direction she was given.
Exactly.
As we've heard, she's not really the litigator in charge, and of course she should follow a court order, but frankly, the responsibility is clearly on the prosecution to make sure everybody's following the court orders. What this reflects, I think, is a big question mark as to whether people in the government across the board are buying the prosecution's theory, and it is hard to buy.
It's hard to buy, and yet the prosecution is between a rock and a hard place, mm-hmm, in the following sense. I think Professor Levinson was right that this case really demonstrates a lack of objectivity on their part, because it's not easy to simply say, well, here's a guy that we thought was maybe connected to 9/11. He's pled guilty.
Right.
We can't give him the death penalty, and so we're just going to walk away. But giving him the death penalty requires that they take seriously a lot of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on death penalty cases, and that is that you can't impose the death penalty on someone who has not caused a death.
Has that ever happened before? I've read that it would be the first time that someone was put to death for failing to inform in advance of a crime.
Well, you know, it's actually, you know, if you look at some of the fact patterns in a bunch of state law cases,
mm-hmm,
you can certainly make that argument, but you could also make the argument that some of the instances that have resulted in death penalty prosecutions are situations where people have been privy to crimes that are going on in their presence, and there's some felony murder going on, and it's unclear whether they've been directly or indirectly involved, and yet ultimately it spirals into a death penalty prosecution. Doesn't happen very often, has happened before, but here I think the link is even more attenuated, and yet the point is that the prosecution has to prove that his failure to come forward caused a death. And as Carla Martin probably saw, and it's quite clear, I'm sure, to anyone who's following the case, that's an extremely difficult case to make. And just to give one reason why, you have to sort of juxtapose the federal government's case in this situation with the body of work from the 9/11 Commission, which I think is an extremely exhaustive effort, and I recommend that report to any American who cares about what happened on 9/11. And their analysis suggests that there are huge and complicated layers of factors that led to this that involve failures of imagination, failures of management, that you just can't then say quite easily that simply if this small fact had been different, then everything would have turned out in a different way.
So, Laurie Levinson, lots of motives at work here then, but the fact remains that Carla Martin appears to have just blown right by the judge's injunction on this. Give us a sense of the sort of atmosphere that nourishes that kind of chutzpah, at the very least, I guess.
Well, part of the problem is we don't know to what extent she was tied into the judge's order. I mean, maybe she got a copy. I assume she did. Otherwise, they couldn't even be talking about contempt. But it seemed to be an indication that she's sort of out of the loop in what the prosecutors are doing. She's supposed to rally up the witnesses, have them on call, but she was not brought under the tent of the prosecutors on any of the strategy or any of the court's orders. And I think the problem here is that the prosecutors have this theory, as was mentioned, that is really cockamamie, because if you think about it, once somebody's in custody and presumably given their Miranda rights, they don't have to say anything at all, so this is going to work contrary. You know, overall, what the prosecutors are betting on, to be frank, is just once this case gets to a jury, the jury will be so upset over 9/11, they're going to want somebody to be held responsible, somebody to die for it. And that's the theory that's going on here. But there are so many problems along the way, and the judge, I think, is extremely frustrated by the lack of coordination among the government officials.
And on the broader picture, Mr. Cuellar, the notion's been put out there that we've got prosecutors kind of running roughshod over the law in terrorism cases. I guess you were alluding to that earlier. But, you know, again and again, we've had big claims put up, then it falls short. In many cases, the cases fall apart. I mean, we saw what happened with Jose Padilla. Got a big tongue lashing from a very pro-administration U.S. appeals court in the Fourth Circuit after the whole dirty bomb thing fell apart. Do we have a kind of sense that the rules don't apply when it comes to prosecuting terrorism, and does that help or hurt?
There's an irony here. I think that you've got a good point that it's easy to draw that inference, but I think that the full story isn't just one of prosecutors running roughshod over the law. I think that there are two other factors that really have to be considered. One is that ever since the, you know, concern about terrorism sort of met the general tendencies that were already implicit in federal law enforcement with respect to the war on drugs, you've seen expansions of counterterrorism statutes in substantial ways. So what looks like a plausible case to even very fair-minded prosecutors now is different. So we have laws, for example, that criminalize various aspects of material support, of giving support to an entity that might have been designated by a separate part of the government as a specially designated organization, a terrorist organization, in the eyes of the government. And so if the rules of the game now are that a prosecutor has to prove something really quite different, not the kind of conspiracy that might have had to be proven before, where an individual is supposed to share the objectives of the organization, but rather just that an individual might have engaged in the provision of, say, expert services to a particular organization, then the range of possible cases you can make is much broader. That's one factor. Factor number two is that there's an extraordinary national pressure here to show competence. And the way you show competence to the public, if you're the government, is not just to simply say, look, we've got everything covered, there won't be any attacks, because you can't prevent attacks, perhaps, but also because you want to show something different. And that's why prosecutors then and investigators are in a position where it's very difficult for them to turn away, even when they see a vaguely promising fact pattern.
So you want to show competence, but then you've got a judge saying she's never seen anything so outside the boundaries. You've got the Washington Post today in an editorial saying this Massawi case joins a line of big terrorism prosecutions marred by government misconduct, overzealousness, hyping of charges, or just plain ineffectiveness.
There have actually been
at least seven cases that I've seen that there have been major mistakes by the prosecution in this war on terrorism. Musawi's only the latest, but as you've mentioned, there's also the Padilla case. In Oregon, there was a case where they arrested a defense lawyer, Brandon Mayfield.
In the Spanish bombing, and he was absolved.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. In Idaho, they had the case against an alleged terrorist for his website. They got an acquittal. In Florida, they had the case against the professor. They had an acquittal. In Detroit, they had their case thrown out for failing to follow the rules on giving over evidence to the defense. And right now in California, we have the Lodi trial, where something unbelievable is happening, where the prosecution has an informant who claimed that bin Laden's number two actually passed through town, bothered to come through Lodi, California. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. which no one believes. You know, everyone in the Muslim community is saying just is a lie. And so it's case after case, they're zealous, as was said, to present to the public that we're very aggressive in this war on terrorism. We're handling it in the courts. But if people look behind it, they're losing in the courts.
People want them to be aggressive, no doubt. But I guess you've got to do it right in order to make it matter. I want to bring our listeners in. A lot have been waiting to join the conversation. Lou's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Lou. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, I can really empathize with the families and the friends of the victims of 9/11 here. You know, it's part of the American culture. You know, with Perry Mason and the, you know, the John Grisham novels, Boston Legal with James Spader. You know, we get this comfort zone that in terms of law and lawyers and legal process, you know, right and righteousness will always prevail. And I think that the sad thing is, just like with O.J. Simpson, the prosecutors and that, I mean, the sad reality is that the legal system, our lawyers, are pathetic.
But what about the comfort zone of the U.S. Constitution and legal procedure? I mean, shouldn't we be able to count on that, or is terrorism somehow different? Do we have to break the rules?
We should be. I would think our lawyers and the legal system, the sense of jurisprudence should be the best in the best in the world with the kind of education system that we have for jurisprudence, and yet it's bungling, it's floundering.
Well, there's a pretty big motivator behind all this with 9/11 sitting there, and yet you've got to do it right to get the right result, I guess. I want to bring another voice into our conversation. From Washington, Paul Butler joins us. He's a former federal prosecutor, helped try and convict four men of the 98 terrorist bombings of U.S. embassies in East Africa, former special assistant to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, a partner at Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld. Paul Butler, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We've just got a minute before the break, but you've heard this team on the Massawi case is getting beaten up here. Do they deserve the beating?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of troubles in the Massawi case, and one issue that I think it raises is, which your caller was alluding to, is the criminal justice system the way to deal with the terrorism problem? I think, you know, terrorism falls in a twilight between crime and war, and you're seeing played out in the Massawi case and some of the other trials that were mentioned the difficulties of using the criminal justice system as a way to prevent and punish terrorism.
But if we don't use it, what about these people who have been found innocent? Would they have been swept off to Guantanamo and thrown in a black hole?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think actually the people that have been taken to Guantanamo, for the most part, as you can see, have not been U.S. citizens or people functioning in the United States, with the exception of one or two cases.
I've been joined from Loyola Law School by Lori Levinson, a former federal prosecutor. She's now director of the Center for Ethical Advocacy at Loyola. From Stanford University by former board member of the ACLU of Northern California, Mariano Florentino Cuellar. And from Washington by Paul Butler, a former federal prosecutor, former special assistant to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, attorney now in Washington. Right now, Laura is calling from Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Laura, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, at the beginning of the show, your first two guests, professors, said that the FAA lawyer had broken the court order. But is that all she violated?
Is
there no constitutional stricture against coaching witnesses, not a violation of due process, or there's no rules of criminal procedure or something other that she should have known about? I mean, even if she didn't.
Yeah, let us look at exactly the alleged offense here. Lori Levinson, how do you define it? The prosecutor said last week, the prosecutors who she was supposed to be working for said her behavior was aberrant and apparently criminal. But exactly why? And is it just the judge's order that she broke here?
It is primarily the judge's order, but your caller raises a really good point, Laura, which is the issue of the ethical responsibilities of all lawyers. Frankly, if she thought that the witnesses had contrary information, that needs to be disclosed to the defense. Ordinarily, on cross-examination, the defense would have an opportunity to find out how much somebody's been coached, what contrary statements they've given. it is wrong to try to get a witness to tell anything other than the truth on the witness stand, but the way we usually handle that is through disclosure. Here, the big offense was violating the judge's order.
Paul Butler, what about the charge of overreach? In some places, it's being described as imperial overreach, that the government's just sort of running roughshod over the law. What are you suggesting, that we take these cases entirely out of the criminal justice system and then put them where?
Well, it's important to reflect on what's happened here. I was fortunate enough to be part of an office, the Southern District of New York, led by Mary Jo White, that was sort of the center of counterterrorism criminal prosecutions before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And starting with the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993 and the prosecution of the blind sheikh for the conspiracy to blow up New York landmarks and the prosecution of Ramzi Youssef all the way through the embassy bombing prosecutions, we were fairly successful. There are always hiccups in big trials like this. Things always happen that you don't anticipate. We were successful from a criminal law standpoint. But as far as disrupting al-Qaeda and winning the war on terrorism, I think 9/11 is a perfect example of the fact that those successful prosecutions didn't really accomplish our foreign policy goals.
And yet you can't take prosecution out of it if there really is planning going on. You've got to address it. So
certainly not. But the point is to disrupt these terrorist cells and to gain intelligence about what their plans are, how they operate, how they're financed, how they interact with each other. The criminal justice system, quite rightly, has many serious civil rights protections for our citizens when the power of the federal government comes down on an individual citizen and accuses them of a crime. The practical result of that, though, of course, the right against self-incrimination, the right to counsel, shuts down the information process and impedes the ability to gain intelligence on terrorism and terrorist cells. So, yes, I mean, if we have an American citizen in the United States or somebody caught in the act of committing a crime, then perhaps a federal court prosecution is the best way to go. But as far as bringing prosecutions in federal courts on these sort of aggressive conspiracy grounds, it only leads to the kind of problems we're seeing in the Massawi trial.
Mariano Florentino,
can I just disagree for a second?
Yes, please.
Mr. Butler's perspective is a very reasonable and understandable one, but I do think there's a different perspective, and that is you can look at what's happening in the Massawi case, and indeed you can look at the record that the 9/11 Commission developed about the whole nation's response to 9/11 and draw the following conclusion from it, and that it's perfectly reasonable to expect that bureaucracies will always be under pressure and they will often fail. They will often not live up to our expectations. People will do the wrong thing, or they just simply won't do the right thing quickly enough.
Yeah.
For all of those reasons, it suggests to me that the constraints associated with the criminal justice system are more, not less, important in a situation like this. And I think that the issue really isn't whether we think or anyone thinks that criminal prosecution is going to disrupt al-Qaeda or other terrorist organizations, because every strategy we have, whether it's disrupting terrorist financing, which is something I've written a great deal about, or criminal prosecution or other uses of discretionary national security authorities, will have their problems and their limitations. And there needs to be a coherent and combined strategy. But if anything, I would suggest that we need to rely on criminal prosecution even more.
But why, let me ask you, Mariano Florentino, Claire, why do you think you've got these foul-ups? Is it because this is just the wrong system for dealing with this? Or is it because prosecutors feel like the rules don't apply because it's terrorism? I mean, is there some signaling going on here that's related to Abu Ghraib getting out of control and, you know, never mind the intelligence, let's juice it? Is there a fabric here that this is part of?
Well, there's something to everything you're saying, but I would put it in this way. The reality is that keeping ourselves safe in a time when terrorism is a threat is a messy, difficult, complicated, complex, and contradictory business. It is not an easy story by any means, and sweeping it into a system where it simply is more difficult for the public to see what the quirks are and what the limitations are, it runs a terrible risk, I think, and that's to encourage the perception among the mass public, which in a democracy is what this all comes down to, that this really can be done by flipping switches, by simply saying someone is guilty on the basis of what a combatant status review tribunal determined, and we're just going to hold our nose and pretend that there really isn't any doubt or any ambiguity, because it's harder for a person to raise the concern that there's reasonable doubt in that context. I think we need to see the messiness. We need to see what the limitations and the difficulties are in order to make a decision about how this should happen in a democracy.
Let me get our callers in here. Sam's on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam, you're on the air.
Well, amen to that last comment. Just going along with that, I just wanted two questions. One is, how much of this fumbling that's happened in the last week or two will be available for the defense to relate to the jury? And second, it seems like that there is as much responsibility by people whose job it is to protect us. From what I understand, Massari was in jail for months, trying to get people from Washington to interview him. All that fumbling seems to be by people who were responsible for protecting us, and I will point out responsibility that then carried over to Katrina. Well, I don't know how many of our own lives were lost. And this seems to be like a witch hunt and a scapegoat hunt that doesn't make us look good. And in fact, for the people outside, it also is horrible in terms of what should be done about 9/11.
Well, but here we've got Massawi, who he's pled guilty. He said, capital murder. Yes, that's me. He put his hand up. Laurie Levinson, what about what's going to be told to the jury here out of all the screw-ups last week?
Well, that's so interesting, and I'm putting it together with the fact that the victim's mother said, you know, what we really want to know is exactly what happened, and I doubt that they're going to hear, even in this trial, exactly what happened. It's likely that the jury, in fact, will not hear much about the coaching by Ms. Martin, because those witnesses would never take the stand. The judge has barred those witnesses from taking the stand, so now, as to the witnesses who do take the stand, it's irrelevant, because they were never coached. And so the jury doesn't necessarily hear the whole mess that's going on, and then in terms of what the victims and the public hear, we don't hear everything that was going on behind the scenes in terms of intelligence failure. And when you read the 9/11 report, one of the primary factors is not so much the Zacharias Moussaoui. I don't think anyone can rely on an individual terrorist to prevent an act like 9/11, but our overall intelligence failures. And these trials aren't going to answer that. But nonetheless, I think they're important. I don't think we should be seeking the death penalty in private secret tribunals because we don't like the messiness, as was said, in the criminal process. When you seek the death penalty, you should make sure everybody's playing by the rules.
Especially when the death penalty call, we understand it. It's based, though, on the notion that this could have been put off. And Carla Martin herself wrote in one of her emails, there's no way anyone could say that the carriers could have prevented all short-bladed knives from going through. Paul Butler, here we are. Americans, they want justice, punishment when it's due, but they don't want people, you know, put on for trial for death penalty without some kind of representation, do they?
Of course not, and I'm not suggesting otherwise. The question is whether trials and tribunals are the proper answer in a war. I mean, the war crimes trials from World War II and the way the military commissions in Guantanamo are designed are to punish people for war crimes, not to determine whether they're released or not. If I could just go back, though, to the death penalty issue on Massawi himself. There have been problems here. There's no question about it. But we have to understand that the prosecutors operate under a particular framework, in this case the death penalty statute, which has four gateway factors that the prosecution needs to analyze before they decide to go for the death penalty. And one of them says that an individual who intentionally participated in an act contemplating that the life of a person would be taken or intending that lethal force would be used and a person dies as a result of that is a proper grounds in which to seek the death penalty. So if they feel that they have facts that support that theory, it's somewhat incumbent upon them, I think, you know, based on desires of the victims and their families, to bring that case forward and let the jury, as the conscience of society, decide whether Mr. Massawi should get the death penalty or not.
So bring it forward, but what we're seeing here is just running roughshod over the rules, and it may never be brought properly forward. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Paul Butler at Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer & Feld in Washington, thank you very much for joining us. And Mariano Florentino Cuellar, law professor at Stanford University. Mr. Cuellar, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Laurie Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School, former federal prosecutor. Ms. Levinson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
This is On Point.